pass issued by General Krennic. My father got it for me. He's president of Interocean Airlines. How far is the palace from here?
Oh, 5 miles. It's much too far to go.
Now, look here. My plane leaves at midnight, and I'm going to have a look at the king if it's the last thing I do. Have you ever seen the king?
Many times.
I've heard he's very handsome. Is that true?
Well, he's fairly attractive, I'd say, and quite susceptible to feminine charms.
Oh, gee, I'd give anything to meet him.
Perhaps before you leave, I can arrange that, too. It had suddenly occurred to me that with Krennic on the streets searching for me, I'd be fairly safe going through the palace in the role of a guide with this American girl. And if I could manage to get into my own private apartments, I could make out a certificate of diplomatic immunity for myself that would get me across the frontier. But in order to do it, I needed the royal seal, which was on my desk. So I decided to take the risk. Half an hour later, we were inside the palace. And as I guided her through the wide corridors that led to my rooms, I kept a sharp eye open for surprises. Follow me, Miss Carpenter.
You certainly know your way around here, Danny.
I've been here before.
Oh, wait.
What is it?
This painting on the wall. Who is he?
Well, that's the king.
Oh.
Oh, what?
He's not as good looking as I thought he'd be.
The artist didn't do him justice.
Oh. Is he married?
No, thank goodness.
What?
He's never met the right girl.
Oh, choosy, isn't he?
Come along, Miss Carpenter.
What's the big hurry? I've got 2 hours before my plane leaves. My luggage is at the airport.
It's getting late. Even though your special pass got us in here very easily, we'll be asked to leave any moment now. Come this way.
You have a key to that door?
It's part of the guide's equipment. Inside.
Why so cautious? You're walking as though you're afraid of being... Why are you going into that desk drawer?
I'm looking for something. I'll be busy for a minute or two. Make yourself at home.
Whose apartment is this?
The king's.
His private room?
Yes.
Look, I don't think we ought to be in here.
You've got my permission.
Your permission? What are you writing on that paper?
Will you please stop asking silly questions and sit down?
Well...
Seal. Where is that seal?
There's something fishy going on around here. I don't believe you're a guide at all.
You're quite right. I'm not. I happen to be the king. Dano the Third, Miss Carpenter.
A king?
I don't have time to explain, but you must listen and believe me. My life is in danger. I've got to get out of the country.
But what...
You have a seat on the plane tonight. Where does it go?
To Paris.
Paris, good. You must get another ticket for me.
But suppose the plane is full?
Miss Carpenter, I'm depending on you. No matter what happens between now and the time the plane leaves, look for me at the airport.
But what about the customs?
They won't stop me, not with this document. I've made it out to Claude Wilbley, giving him complete customs immunity and signed and sealed by the king.
Oh.
It won't be questioned.
Off over, I will shoot to kill, Krennic.
Who are you?
King Dano's bodyguard. This man is a hired assassin.
Assassin?
Then listen to him, Miss Carpenter.
I think you had better leave the palace, young lady, and say nothing about this matter to anyone on the outside. I know who you are, and I assure you that you will not receive notorious publicity in regard to this.
I don't think I understand.
This man is a traitor to his country, not the king's bodyguard, as he claims. If anything happens to me, you must say the king was murdered. Do you hear? Murdered by traitors and foreign enemies.
But who are you, really? I'm so confused.
I am the king, Miss Carpenter.
You can see you are dealing with a madman. You saw the king's portrait. Does this man look like that picture?
No. No, he doesn't.
Then I suggest you go and leave him to me.
Very well.
Miss Carpenter.
I'm lucky I'm still alive.
And so are you, Dano. But your luck is running out.
So it seems.
You were a fool to try to get away. Now you have made it easier for me.
Have I?
Your body will be identified as an enemy saboteur sent to murder the king.
And how will you explain the king's absence?
Oh, very simply. The assassin succeeded. We will proclaim a state of mourning and a royal funeral for an empty casket, of course. These things can be arranged.
Someday, Krennic, you'll find yourself on the wrong end of the gun, in front of a firing squad.
Meanwhile, it is you who faces the business end, Dano. Goodbye. Or, as we say in our native language, Ashti Presnik. Good riddance.
I stiffened with the shot, expecting the sting of steel through my heart. But it was Krennic who fell to the floor at my feet. I turned, and there behind me was Cherik, my friend and valet, with a smoking revolver in his hand.
Cherik! Hurry, Your Majesty. You must leave the palace.
But what about you, Cherik?
Never mind about me. It's your safety that counts.
No, I can't leave now. They'll hang you.
Don't worry about me, sire. I shot him to protect my king. It was either his life or yours. They won't catch me. Quickly, go through the open terrace window where I came in. The gardens are clear. Hurry!
But I still had to get a place on board the plane for Paris. And when I reached the airport, they told me the plane was fully booked. I tried to talk my way into a seat, but it was no use. Just as I had freedom in my fingers, it was slipping away again. But I've got to have a seat, I tell you. There must be an open booking.
You're right, Danny. The plane's full. I bought the last seat an hour ago.
Oh, Miss Carpenter.
And I've bought it for you.
How can I repay you?
Very simply. Just send me an autographed picture so I can brag about really meeting a king.
That was 2 years ago. And since then, I've been enjoying the world at my leisure. Although I must admit that working for a living has its drawbacks. However, I have my compensations. And I see that my most fortunate compensation is approaching our table now.
Your Majesty.
What is it, Cherik?
It's your turn to be host at dinner tonight. What would you like me to prepare?
Use your own discretion, Cherik, but keep a steady eye on the royal purse.
I'll deliver the usual invitations, of course, to King Randolph, King Alex, and King Rupert.
Yes, and tell Rupert we won't take offense if he's a bit tardy. I understand he's driving his taxi on the second shift now. Meanwhile, I must attend to business, Cherik. And this American gentleman is anxious to visit the Prince's Palace. With your permission, sir, I lead the way. The Royal Palace, as you know, is occupied by the reigning monarch. At present, Prince...
In the animal world, there is the hunter and the hunted. Hound and fox, hawk and sparrow, chicken and worm. But who is to judge precisely which is the pursuer or the pursued as we enter the chase? The Chase was created for the National Broadcasting Company by Lawrence Klee. Heard in the cast were Lloyd Bachner, Ann Sargent, William Podmore, Peter Capel, and Danny Occo. The Chase is directed and transcribed by Fred Wade. Fred Collins speaking. Next week, a new star makes a brief appearance on the Hollywood horizon. A star who is pursued relentlessly and finally cornered in The Chase. Listen to the latest prisoner of war news tonight on NBC.
We're listening to the Moon, coming to you from CKUW 95.9 FM Winnipeg, here with Mr. Mumbles.
Pleasure to introduce to you the important show, Mr. Ed Hunter, foremost authority on psychological warfare. Hunter has been a journalist for better than 40 years, served as a propaganda specialist with in World War II. He is the author of Brainwash in Red China and several other books about which I'll ask Mr. Hunter to tell you about a little bit later. But Mr. Hunter heard brainwashing when he investigated how our GIs were brainwashed by the Chinese Reds. And I suspect we will hear a great deal more about that from Mr. Hunter. First of all, Mr. Hunter, it's a pleasure to have you on our important show.
I'm very happy to be here.
And we're very, very interested in your past history and involved in serving as a propaganda specialist and authority in psychological warfare.
Actually, I haven't been doing any newspaper work for some years now. Although I've probably spent 30 consistent years on the payroll of some newspaper or news agency somewhere. You mentioned the brainwashing that I came across, you intimated, in Korea, which isn't actually the case. Actually, I spoke of brainwashing and revealed the technique of brainwashing before the Korean War. This has been a very serious misconception created in the United States by the Korean War. What is called brainwashing is a system of pressures used by communists primarily against their own people, not against an enemy or against outsiders. The use of it in the Korean War was utterly gravy so far as the Reds were concerned. Brainwashing is a pressure system to keep the peoples under communism under control.
Mr. Hunter, before we get into the big subject of brainwashing, I know it's a very large one, I'd like to know a little bit more about your past and yourself.
I, as a young man, went into newspaper work or journalism, it seems a couple of generations ago now, at least, especially when I realized that I went into newspaper work when there was no such thing as an official spokesman, when there were no government spokesmen, and when newspaper men went to first-hand sources, sought out the first-hand source to find out what had happened. When I first joined the newspaper, I remember the instructions I received from the city editor to go out and find out what had happened from the people involved. And official communiques and official statements were not permitted. You wrote your own story. And the great change that has taken over journalism in my time, and I'm not an old man, is this change from journalism with initiative. People went out and covered stories and got the facts and let the chips fall where they may. And the present efficient system, efficient in everything except the coverage of truth, in which you first find out who is the official spokesman. Of course, that official spokesman has to do a job. His job is to represent either a government office or a business house, and he obviously is going to tell what is favorable for his group or his organization, which is perfectly proper for him. What is not proper is for the so-called newspaper man to accept that as the truth.
Would you then, excuse me, Mr. Hunter, take issue with what newsmen today call an actuality as opposed to a reporter's initiative or a correspondent?
Well, what
initiative?
I see is a, I don't, that, I haven't heard quite that a comparison. When I was in journalism, a newspaper man went out for scoops. He went out for information that he could obtain in spite of the official, in spite of those who were connected with an organization, to get the facts. That was a scoop. Now he doesn't. He goes out for an exclusive. That is something that slipped along to him, especially in government offices in Washington. You scratch my back and I scratch yours. You take my official document, which is based perhaps on utter lies and on what they call news management, and we will make sure that you get an exclusive and maybe an invitation to a party at the White House.
That will bring us to another subject as well, news management. Let me ask you about your war service, Mr.
Before going into the war, I believe in destiny. And how could I believe otherwise from my own background? I became a specialist in psychological warfare, not by planning, certainly not by my own planning, but by the cause of events. I covered, for instance, from the inside, the creation of the puppet state of Manchugorje when the Japanese invaded Manchuria. That was a long time ago. That was the first example of modern psychological warfare, the creation of an independent puppet state. I covered two civil wars in Spain, the rehearsal for the big civil war in the Basque country in the north, and the main civil war. I covered the conquest of Ethiopia by Mussolini. I saw that, and I'm very proud of experience there. I was the only correspondent for any big news agency I was in was Hearst, who was not given a medal by Mussolini and Ciano.
What was your role as a member of the OSS?
Then, when the war began, I was working in New York City as a foreign editor on the New York Post. And I discovered one day that I had been employed by OSS. They had been investigating me for a year. I found out only later. And I was informed that I was hired.
Then
I went to the CBI Theater, the China-Burma-India Theater in Asia, because I had experience in Asia. I had been editor of several newspapers in China, English-language newspapers. I'd been editor of an English-language newspaper, the Japan Advertiser, in Tokyo.
Let's get back to this word, brainwashing. How did you come across this word, or what prompted you to use it for the first time?
Actually, if I had not had all this experience through destiny in psychological warfare as a newspaper man, and then gone on the inside during the war and served the OSS and saw things from the other side of the curtain, I never would have been able to really recognize what was brainwashing. But with this very exhaustive background, I was covering Asia, working then for the Cox chain of newspapers, and at Hong Kong, a friend of mine came out of Red China on a mission for the communists. He was a young man whose family I had known, a Chinese, and we spent a number of days together, usually in a car driving around the hills of Hong Kong, or in my room in the press club when he was telling me what was taking place. And he referred during the conversation to Xi Nao. Xi Nao, Chinese for washed grain. And I stopped him at once and I said, wait, what is this? Because it seemed to ring a bell. And he said, he brushed it off. He realized he'd gone a little far. And he said, that's nothing at all. You know, when a group of us in this honeymoon period in Shanghai, very intimate friends, maybe relatives, somebody makes a comment that the communists don't like, somebody's probably going to say to him, now watch out, you're going to get a brainwashing. Well, the moment I heard that, it brought together a number of different developments and events which somehow I had realized had been interrelated, but I didn't quite understand. And it set me down into renewed research, so that I not only put the word into our language, I was the first one to use the word brainwashing in print, in any language, in writing.
And what year was this, Mr. Hunter?
About 1950. And I was the first one to use the word brainwashing in speech in any language except for this little group of Chinese. And the word would have died out because the commies certainly didn't like it. They didn't want that technique to be known. So what is much more important is not so much the putting of the word into our language, but revealing the content of the word, the new type of warfare, the new dimension to warfare that the word brainwashing represents.
During what the years of World War II were you in the CBI, Mr. Hunter? I'm curious.
Yes.
Because I, too, spent time
there. Ah, I was in the CBI for the, the couple of years before the atom bomb was dropped in Japan. I was in the area of Burma, India, South China. I had my staff at one time cut out of the in an area cut out of the jungle in Burma, staff composed of a Chinese staff, a Japanese staff, a Thai staff, in which we engaged in what's called clandestine warfare, propaganda warfare. And this is what worries me here in the United States today. The tactics that I saw there, that I participated in, the black clandestine tactics of propaganda warfare that were used then and developed then for use against an enemy, I now see being used against the American public here in our country.
I think I can say truthfully that I saw some of this too. I was a reporter for this station in Calcutta and New Delhi and Kunming.
Are you sure that I never saw you in Calcutta? I used to, when I was in Calcutta, in what was called a building called K, I used to stop over to where the newspaper correspondents gathered and sit around there for a little while and chat and then leave. Maybe the blood of journalism was too much for me, and I'd come and poke my nose around and get some of the stimulation that one always obtains from the old-fashioned newspaper crowd.
Well, most of my time there, Mr. Hunter, was spent at a Armed Forces radio station that had commercial facilities, and this was followed by my being a radio spokesman for General Orand of Services of Supply in the China Theater in Kunming, China.
Yeah, in Kunming.
Right.
Well, there, Kunming, I saw quite a bit of course. That was the headquarters at a time for CAT, the civil air transport of that great American General Chenault, and who, it might be worth mentioning, one of the great heroes of the American side in the war, one of America's greatest heroes ever, who, because of politics of the 1960s, is being besmirched. A
this
man named John Birch, one of the truly great heroes of our side in the war, and one of America's greatest heroes ever. He did not have to die. He could have talked himself out of that last mission, but he refused. He insisted on going through with it because the war was ended. And as he said then, that if the communists would kill Americans, if they would ambush Americans, then it was time for the United States to know it, and someone would have to put it to a test. The man had actual foresightedness, clairvoyance. He saw. He had a peculiar capacity, not merely for the Chinese language. He could pass for a Chinese. He had a great capacity that enabled him, for instance, beyond the spot when Doolittle landed in China, and he led Doolittle out. He was a man who created the network that saved so many American flyers, and which obtained for General Chenault the data from inside China that enabled our side to knock the stuffings out of the Japanese so frequently. Unfortunately, because later he was in OSS, there was a hush-hush, and because the communists killed him, the type of people who passed for newspaper men there, and the type of individual who passed for a government official then, decided to hush up on his murder because it might provoke the communists and upset the pleasant negotiations that they believed that they were then engaging in. But this is just
very interesting comments on that. I
this has
heard
nothing
this
to do with
it.
The John Birch Society. Of course, he never heard of the John Birch Society. Whether one likes the John Birch Society, dislikes it, has nothing to do with John Birch. John Birch is a great hero, and one of the most revolting things I have come across in my lifetime has been the slimy effort to besmirch the name of John Birch because one doesn't like the John Birch Society.
In the time that we have, and I know it's going by rapidly, Mr. Hunter, I would like to have you give me very simply, if it is possible, the techniques
of
what we call brainwashing.
Brainwashing consists of two processes. One process is softening up. The other process is indoctrination. Softening up is what mainly took place in the prisoner of war camps in Korea. And softening up is what is taking place in the United States today. Each of these two processes is composed of a number of elements that include threats, tenseness, fatigue, hunger, atrocities, pressures of that sort. I write about them in the book Brainwashing in Red China, which is now undergoing a new printing. Will be out in about 1 month with a new preface I have written connecting these facts with what is taking place now in Cuba. Vanguard will have the book out in about 1 month, they told me. And then I have also given details on this in the book Brainwashing from Pavlov to Powers. But in that latter book, what is much more important, I don't merely tell what destroys a mind, but I provide the formula for the preservation of a mind. And that is much more important.
Are there people and organizations here in the United States prone to the brainwashing technique?
Do you mean agencies of government?
Correct.
yes, excuse me, I think there are various agencies studying brainwashing, but what worries me much more is the intrigue, the intriguing effect this has had upon some of our politicians and some of our people in executive offices who have become enamored of it and forget that this is something that is not intended to be used for political purposes against the American public, but against an enemy. And it is now under such names as news management, which means lying to the American public or distorting information, being utilized by our government against our people.
Let's talk about news management for a moment as it relates to Cuba, Mr. Hunter.
We have had the example of the whole recent Cuban affair as news management. News management in quotes. I use that term because that is the term used by the government. I am not saying something that I thought up myself. News management and news as a weapon were admitted by the Pentagon, by the official spokesman. News management has included concealment of news, distortion of news. In the Cuban affair, if the American public had known what took place, for instance, in the invasion of the Bay of Pigs, the betrayal there, if they had known that when the orders came, excuse me, to betray these invaders, one American flyer refused to participate in such a dishonorable act, and he took off in his plane, and he attacked the Reds on Cuba and fought them low flying until he was shot down and killed. And two men, I am told, of the Central Intelligence Agency committed suicide. If the American public had realized that, and the horrible betrayal, something as ugly as our page as regards the freedom fighters in Hungary, the American public would have acted very, very differently in the last election.
From what source does this suppression stem, Mr. Hunter?
Of information?
Correct.
From the executive offices of the United States government in Washington. People who have very inflated egos and who believe that in this modern society, you require a government of the elite. People who know the answers and who will do the thinking for the public. They call themselves liberals, but they are not liberals. I have been a liberal all my life, and this has been no more liberalism than it is monarchism. It certainly is closer to dictatorship.
Has there been a relationship between news management and suppression regarding Berlin?
Of course. There is, what I am told in Washington, a deal in the making on Berlin. that there is a great deal of manipulation taking place, that Cuba is related to the Berlin, as that Laos is related, one to set the example and the precedent for the other. But if, for instance, it is not without significance, and it is part of news management, that whereas a resolution passed by the Congress, the House and the Senate, urging the President to take a firm stand as regards Cuba was given tremendous publicity. But the similar resolution, and a similar one was passed by both the House and the Senate, regards to Berlin, has been given almost no publicity, and the White House used every pressure it could to prevent that resolution from being passed. I was in Washington then.
Mr. Hunter, you delivered testimony in hearings some while ago on the Senate investigation of Pentagon gagging. I'd like to hear something about that.
You're referring to the testimony I gave that is entitled The New Drive Against the Anti-Communist Program. This was published by the Library of Congress and resulted in the series of hearings held in the Senate on the gagging of military officers. I would like to urge everyone to get the report, the official report, on those Pentagon gagging hearings. One need send only 55 cents to the U.S. government printing office and ask for the report on the Pentagon gagging hearings and read the words of the various senators, both liberal and conservative, because that information is required by the American public if they are going to vote intelligently. Incidentally, I think I can mention that testimony I gave on the new drive against the anti-communist program has sold more copies than any other political document ever published by the government printing office, and that its price is 25 cents. I can mention that because Uncle Sam pays no royalty. I get no benefit out of it. Only the taxpayer does.
Mr. Hunter, as you have traveled about the country talking to various organizations on your experiences and your knowledge, what has been your immediate reaction to the reaction of the people who have heard you? Have they been apathetic?
No. I have found out that there is a grassroots anti-communist movement in the United States, a genuine people's reaction to what is taking place in the tradition of the New England town meeting. American people wanting to know what there is about this communist menace and what they can do about it. And it is one of the most beautiful things I have ever come across in my own country. And it is this which the inflated egos in Washington, those who believe in a government by the elite, are doing their best to suppress, this natural expression of American tradition of finding out what there is in a problem and finding out what they can do about it. For some reason or other, Washington, the government, is determined to suppress this.
In the final minute or so that we have, we would like very much to hear of some of the books you have written, Mr. Hunter, and where they might be secured here in the city.
I think you ought to be able to obtain them either from the publishers or through one of the bookshops. There is the department...
I think you mentioned the Higbee Department.
The Higbee Department Store. I today only saw in the Higbee Department Store a pile of copies of Brainwashing from Pavlov to Powers. Also the book, the Black Book on Red China, and in the paperback section, they have a fine paperback section, the book Brainwashing. Also the book Brainwashing in Red China, the book that made history and put the word into the language, that is appearing in a new reprint in about in a few weeks, and should be obtainable through the bookshops or through the publisher direct. Then there is the story of Mary Liu, L-I-U, a Chinese lady, a most heroic true life story Unfortunately, that book is out of print. I'm hoping that it will be reprinted. It is to be found, I think, in most public libraries. And there is another book that is not published here. It was published in England by Hodder and Stoughton. The book entitled The Past, Present, A Year in Afghanistan. The reason I mention that is because it emancipated the women of Afghanistan. As a result of that book, the royal family of Afghanistan decided to allow the women of that country, the Muslim women, prepare to be shocked, to go out in public with naked faces.
Mr. Hodder, it's been a pleasure talking to you today on our important show. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been our pleasure to present to you Mr. Ed Hodder, one of the world's foremost authorities on psychological warfare, coiner of the expression brainwashing, and the author of very interesting books on this subject. And Mr. Hodder, we hope to talk to you again someday.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard a repeat of a broadcast heard 2 weeks ago on WJW's Sunday afternoon important series. The interview with Mr. Hodder is just one of many excellent programs in this series designed to stimulate the thinking and action of us all. The important show is heard Sunday afternoons at 5:30 over this station. Your comments on tonight's broadcast would be appreciated.
You're listening to the Moon, coming to you from CKUW 95.9 FM.
Wheaties presents Dimension X. Adventures in time and space, transcribed in future tense. Dimension X. On stage tonight, Dimension X, another in the Wheaties big parade of exciting half-hour presentations.
Just about the time you're getting up tomorrow morning, you know what's happened? You've been without food for so long that you gotta get more if you're gonna get your work done. That's why first you need your Wheaties. Sure, Wheaties. Because when you dip into those golden flakes, you're getting real whole wheat. Yep, every single Wheaties is a kernel of wheat. And you know what that means. Vitality for working well, feeling well, looking well. Whole wheat energy. Whole wheat vitamins. All the goodness of plump whole wheat in crisp little flakes that are mighty nice to meet any morning of the week. So be good to yourself. Tuck into the Wheaties at 7 a.m. and see if you don't feel the difference. Have yourself breakfast of champions and see how Wheaties at 7 can help at 11. Come on now, try them.
What will happen when man, finally conquering the galactic distances of interstellar travel, finds life on the strange worlds across the universe? Will he discover civilizations of incredibly advanced scientific knowledge, or primitive cultures deep in a stone age of savagery? Here is a story of the relation between men of our world and beings from beyond the stars. On the desk stood a yellow bowl, the profile a simple curve, clean and sharp. The body was thin without fragility, and the beauty of its shape was matched by the glowing intensity of the glaze, a glorious transparent yellow, soothing as sunlight, yet glowing with the fire of a volcano's core. The desk belonged to Michael Tom, regional administrator for the Department of Interplanetary Affairs.
That bowl? Why, it's a souvenir. I got it many years ago on the planet Fursk. I'd been out on the Channel planet in the Frontier Service for 19 months. When my transfer came through to Fursk, I was surprised to see that I'd been promoted 3 grades, and my orders read to report to the regional office as assistant resident. My ship came in at Penolpan Spaceport, and I was met by the office car and chauffeur.
Mr. Tom?
That's right.
I'm Wirichek, sir. Welcome to Fursk.
Thanks. Well, I didn't expect to find a 1992 Rolls here.
The resident had it shipped out in parts. Mr. Koval changes every year for the new model.
Pretty smooth. Hey, this is certainly different from the Channel planet. Nothing there but ice, frost, please, and the dullest aborigines in the system.
Well, you won't find the aborigines very dull here.
What kind of people are they? The Metoon?
Well, they're humanoid. Very close to us, systemically. Tall, sort of amber-colored and graceful.
Hmm. Oh, is that one, the girl balancing the bowl on her head?
Yeah. Yeah, she's a Metoon. There isn't a very big human population at first.
Well, well, well. Looks like Mike Tom has found a home in the service.
You haven't met Mr. Colville yet, have you?
What do you mean by that?
Oh, nothing, sir, nothing.
Look, we're a check. If there's anything wrong, you'd better tell me.
Well, there's nothing, sir. Nothing you won't find out. It's just that Mr. Colville is a very forceful personality. Very forceful.
We drove through Penolpan, threading our way through narrow streets between rows of low houses of reed, parchment, and wood. Canals of green water laced the city, and the bridges trailed ivy and orange flowers. Suddenly, we turned a corner, and there on the bank of the main canal was a large concrete and glass building, Earth-style. This was the district office, and in a room that gleamed with black plastic and glass, I found George Colville, senior resident.
You're Tom? Michael Tom?
Yes, sir.
My last junior took off for the hills with a dancer from a Metoon grog shop. If I have any trouble with you, I'll ship you back to Earth with a minus 50 efficiency rating. That clear?
That's clear, sir.
And don't get edgy with me. Sit down. Now listen, Tom, I'm easy to get along with. I like things done right the first time. Got to give a good example for the gooks.
Gooks?
Yeah, the natives. I don't know what's good for them. I brought in a high-grade silica yarn to replace the root fiber they were using in fishnets. Took me 3 months to talk them into using it.
I thought the Bureau policy was to avoid introducing Earth technology to stable cultures.
Yeah, that's what those boneheads at the main office say. They don't have to live here. Have you seen those pigsties they live in? There isn't a concrete building on the planet.
The Metoon delegation, Mr. Colville.
Tell them I'm busy for 15 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll be going along then, sir.
Why?
Well, if you're busy...
Forget it. I always let those gooks wait at least 15 minutes. Softens them up. They're not hard to handle, if you know how.
I was assigned to pest control, a duty Colville considered beneath his dignity. In the next few weeks, I carted rat poison and insect spray through the poorest sections of Penolpan, where the trees ended and the plains stretched out to the Kukmak Mountains. It was there that I first heard of the potters of Fersk. I had found a pottery bazaar, long shelves of jars of every size and shape, crocks, paper-thin vases, bowls, demijohns, tankards. The glazes were remarkable, deep, glowing colors. And yet, something was missing. I looked up and down the shelves.
Mr. Tom, is anything wrong?
No, it's just... I've got it. There isn't any yellow.
Yellow?
That's right, there are no yellow glazes at all. They have every other color, ruby, green. There's a jar that's translucent, but no yellow.
Well, maybe it's a superstition.
Could be. Yellow might be connected with death or disease.
Well, you can find out, Mr. Tom. Here comes a Metoon. She probably runs the place.
May I help you, sir?
Oh, you speak English.
I must. We trade with the Earth colony.
Your wares are very beautiful. For example, how much is this bowl?
75 credits.
That much?
They are our ancestors. And to sell them as cheaply as wood or glass would be irreverent.
Your ancestors? You mean the bowls?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Tell me, where's the pottery made? In Penolpan?
No, back there.
In the mountains?
There our ancestors go and the pots are brought back. Aside from this, I know nothing. The Metoon fear the potters.
Why?
No one knows what lies beyond the first hill, Earthmen. Sometimes we see the glow of furnaces. And when there are no dead for the potters, they take the living.
Living?
There are the potters now.
What are they shouting?
That they have sold all their wares. That they will ride back to the mountains now.
Hey, big devils, aren't they? Red hair.
They are very strong.
I think I'll visit the potters one of these days.
No, Earthman.
No? Why not?
It is dangerous for you. They have guarded their secrets from all Penolpan. They are very fierce.
Tom, where the devil you been? I told you to get the estimates for that power plant.
I put them on your desk, sir.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so you did.
Say, what do you know about the Potters back in the Cookmanks, Mr. Colville?
Huh? Oh, they're a tribe of bandits or something. Why?
I was at the bazaar today. A girl called the vases ancestors. Seems strange.
Ancestors? Well, it probably has something to do with religious death rites. They take away the dead bodies and cremate them for a fee or trade goods. And
the girl said that when they don't get the dead, sometimes they take the living.
What? Well, so that's it.
What, sir?
Raiding. About every month or so, a couple of me too and turn up missing. The whole city clams up like tongue-tied parrots. For 2 years, I've been trying to track it down. Tom, these Potters must be behind it. Raiding, huh? Well, we'll see about that.
No, we don't know anything definite.
Well, we will. Get Werecheck to roll out the copter. We're flying out to those mountains. I'll put a stop to this if I have to blow them clean off the planet. We'll never find a village in that mess down there. Look at those cliffs.
There's a smoke trail over there to the right. Potters need kilns. Kilns need heat.
That's a volcano, not a chimney. Let's try out along that ridge, then we'll go back.
Wait, I think we found them.
Where?
At the base of the volcano. Look close. You can see buildings.
Yeah. Set her down.
Should we land, sir? They're supposed to be pretty rough on home ground.
We're official representatives of the system. Remember that.
That might not mean much to a tribe of mountaineers.
Don't argue with me, Tom. Land. Pistol ready.
I don't see anybody. The village is deserted.
They're hiding.
It's the Potters, all right. There's a heap of old broken jars. But I don't see the kiln.
We'll stay here till something moves. What's that?
One of the Potters. Wait a minute. Here they come. Three of them.
You cover them, Tom. I'll do the talking. Hey there, you.
What brings strangers to the village of the Potters?
I'm Colville, chief of the Planetary Affairs Bureau in Penolpan. This is an official visit to see how things are going with you.
We make no complaints.
Oh? I've heard reports of you Potters kidnapping Meetun. Is there any truth in that?
There is an ancient agreement. The Potters are granted the bodies of the dead. And occasionally, when the need is great, we do anticipate nature by a year or two.
You mean you admit it?
The soul lives forever in the bowl it beautifies.
What do you mean? Look here, just what do you do with the corpses?
Our glazes require lead, sand, clay, alkali, spar, and lime. All but the lime is at our hand, and this we take from the bones of the dead.
I see. Well, we don't want to interfere in any native customs or rights. Corpses, that's between you and the Meetun. If you need lime, I can ship you in tons of it.
Natural lime is a poor substitute for fresh live bones. The spirit of the person is in the bones, and it passes into the glaze and gives it an inner fire.
Well, you listen to me. I don't care what you use as long as there's no kidnapping or murder.
Tell me, Potter. I don't see any furnaces. Where are your kilns?
Our firing is done by the great monthly burn.
You mean the volcano?
Yes, Earthman. Once each month, the heat roars up white and glowing.
I see. Potter, why don't you ever use yellow glaze?
Yellow glaze. We have no metal to give the pure, rich yellow, the color of the sun. It is strange, Earthman, that you talk of the yellow, for my people have sought the sun glaze for thousands of years.
Listen, if there's any technical help you people want, that's my business. But there'll be no more murder. If necessary, I'll put a stop to the potting altogether.
Your words are not friendly.
Don't think I can't do it. I'll drop an atom bomb down the throat of your volcano and cave in the whole mountain.
We'd better pull out, Mr. Colville.
Shut up, Tom. You understand? My job is to protect everyone on this mudhole planet. And that includes the Meetun.
Get back in the copter, Mr. Colville. They're getting ugly.
Fire over their heads. Keep them back.
Quick, get in, sir. They're scared now, but in a minute they may jump us.
All right, let's go. Don't worry, Tom. Now those gooks know who's boss. Now, sir, we won't have any more trouble from the Potters.
Colville kept me pretty busy the next few weeks. But I got to spending a good deal of time at the Pottery Bazaar with the girl. Her name was Su Thin. She was interested in everything I had to tell her about the rest of the galaxy, and I was lonely, so I got to looking forward to my visits there. I was on my way there one evening when suddenly I heard shouts down the side streets. I hurried toward them, pulling out my gun. And then I heard the deep cry of the giant potters and the crack of hooves on the cobbled streets. Suddenly, a group of riders burst around a corner and charged down on me. When they were gone, I hurried to the Pottery Bazaar. Su Thin was gone.
Earthman! Earthman! She is not here. They took her.
The potters?
She has gone to her ancestors.
Did they kill her?
No. No, they have taken her to the hills. But soon she will live forever, her spirit wrapped in the glorious glaze.
So then?
There is nothing to be done. When the potters take you, it is the end.
I've been raiding again, huh?
Pour me two in tonight.
Bring the copter around in front.
It's ready.
Tom, I'm going to break out the atom bomb from the arms locker. You fly out there and drop it down that volcano crater. I'll teach those murdering devils a lesson they won't forget.
But the meat
will come crawling to the city on their hands and knees. I know how to run this planet.
Dimension X will continue in just a moment.
Friends, this is Frank Martin, the Wheaties man, and I want you to know an associate of mine, Ed Prentice. Okay, Ed.
Folks, I'd like to have you meet a good friend of mine and a prominent member of a fine little organization known as the Chicago White Sox, Mr. Lucius Benjamin Affleck.
Ooh, Ed, don't say it like that. Whoever heard of a ball player named Lucius? What if I went around calling you Paul Edward Prentice? Let's just make it Ed and Luke, huh?
All right, Luke. Say, just how long have you been with the White Sox?
Over 20 years, Ed. Golly, I played in darn near 2,500 games. Been at bat almost 9,000 times. Man, I'm from way back.
Well, Luke, you don't look it. How do you keep up the pace, anyway?
Well, Ed, I sleep good. I eat good. I eat mighty good. Wheaties about four mornings a week. Those little old flakes put a lot of snap, even in an old-timer like me. Must be because they're 100% whole wheat. I sure like Wheaties and milk and fruit.
You know, Luke, that's exactly what I hear from a lot of ball players and plenty of other people, too. No wonder they call Wheaties the breakfast of champions.
Thank you, Mr. Prentice and Mr. Luke Appling of the Chicago White Sox. Mighty nice of you to say those good things about Wheaties. Now, folks, you and I may not be playing baseball for a living, but we can use those whole wheat Wheaties, too. Step around to the grocery tomorrow yourself for Wheaties, breakfast of champions. Breakfast for you.
There's the village widow, Chick. Swing over it.
Shall I pull the safety on the bomb?
No, hold it.
But Mr. Colville said...
I know what he said. They got a girl down there, and I'm going to get her out alive. And I'm going to start by trying to talk with that 7-foot red-headed potter. All right, widow, Chick. Set her down right in the middle of Main Street. Have your gun ready, Wirichek. Here they come. Tall one, the chief.
So, this is the insolent lordling again.
Come on, out of the copter.
Good. We are in need of bone lime, and yours will suit us well.
They're closing in, Mr. Tom.
Prepare your soul for the great burn.
Stand back. I'll kill a lot of potters, and you'll be the first. I've come for the four Me Too that you took from Pinole. You don't seem to understand that we can punish.
We can kill you before you can do much damage. We potters do not fear death. Death is merely eternal meditation from the glass.
Potter, listen to me. I didn't come here to threaten, but to bargain. You have a Me Too and girl. Is she still alive?
She still lives.
Chief Colville gave me orders to destroy your volcano. We can do that easily. If I'm harmed, the next bomb will drop on your village. I've come down here against his orders to bargain.
Bargain? With what? We care for nothing but our craft.
Potter, I can give you the secret of the yellow glaze.
Empty words.
No, the truth. In exchange, I want the girl and the other Me Too and you've stolen,
And your word not to raid again.
How would we get lime?
We've told you, we can ship it in. Pure lime, as good as yours. Do the potters of Fersk want the yellow glaze?
Why, that has been the goal of the tribe of potters for 1,000 years.
And if I show you the yellow glaze?
Earthmen, if it comes clear through the burn, I agree to your bargain. If it does not, your spirit will be lodged forever in the ugliest bowl we can spin on the wheel.
It's a bargain. All right, Wiracek. Disarm the bomb.
Disarm it? Mr. Tom, are you crazy? They'll kill us. There'll be nothing left to stop them.
Nothing but the yellow glaze.
Yeah, but do you know how to make it?
We'll soon find out. I've been doing a little reading on the subject lately.
Reading? Holy smoke.
Enough, Earthman. I will take you to the potter's shed. If your glaze is the bright yellow of the sun, you live. If not, you die.
Come on, Wiracek. Let's get to work.
With what? You never made a glaze in your life. What are we supposed to work on now? Our last will and testament?
Who's that?
Susan.
Are you all right?
Yes. Why did you come? They will kill you too, Earthman.
Maybe. How did you get in here?
When I heard that you were here, I asked the chief potter to come. He said it would not matter. They would have all our bones soon.
Cheerful, Zol. Hey, stir this, Wiracek.
Yes, sir.
They said you were trying to make the yellow glaze. Oh, Earthmen, we will die.
This goo may turn out yellow. It had better.
No one on Fersk has been able to make it.
But I'm not from Fersk. Hang on, Suthan, we're not dead yet.
Earthmen, I am glad you came. Although I wish you had not.
Suthan. All right, Wiracek. Call that redhead. Tell him I got his glaze ready.
Hey! Hey, you out there.
Earthman, are you ready?
Here's your glaze. Test it.
You have 6 bowls of glaze.
I'm no potter. This stuff ought to turn out yellow, but I can't be sure in one mixture.
We will coat 6 tablets, one with each glaze. Then we will fire them.
How long will it take?
20 hours before you know if the burn has brought you life or death.
How long can they keep that up? It's been hours.
Tiles ought to be done soon.
Earthman, here comes the chief potter.
It must be time.
The tiles are cooled. It is time now to open the kiln and test your glaze. A bargain has been made. The glaze is yellow or you die. I will open the kiln.
How are they, Mr. Tom? Mr. Tom?
I can't see inside. It's dark. All right, Potter, pull them out. What are you waiting for?
I will remove the first tile.
No.
A dull, dirty brown, Earthman.
Pull out the next one.
The color of mud. Hiya!
Now, wait a minute.
What is the use? There is no yellow glaze.
Get that next tile out. We made a bargain.
This is Earth Brown. Your glazes are worse than the feeblest work of our children. Prepare your spirits for the great burn.
Now, wait. Look in there. The next tile. Get it out here.
Earthman, you waste time.
Well, I'll get it out myself. There. Look at it.
Yellow. Bright, shining yellow.
There it is. The yellow glaze.
Tom, where in thunder have you been?
Mr. Colville, I've been trying...
I sent you out on business which should take 2 hours, and you stay 2 days. Why?
I got the 4-me-2 and back, and I made a contract with the Potters. No more raiding.
You what?
I made a deal with them, and it turned out to be a better idea than yours.
You disobeyed. You deliberately... Tom, you're through here. through with planetary affairs.
Listen, Mr.
The man can't be trusted to carry out orders. He's not worth a lead nickel to the Bureau. Get your gear together. Leave on the next ship out.
Yes, sir.
Wait. You're on company time to 4 o'clock tonight. Until then, you obey my orders. Take the copter back to the hangar. Bring the atom bomb back to the armory.
I can't.
What?
I've been trying to tell you. There's only one way I had to make that yellow glaze.
Tom, what the devil have you done with that bomb?
I gave it to the Putters.
What?
It was a uranium salt that made the yellow glaze.